Welcome to Keep Making Movies, the podcast where we explore, shall we say, movies that may have needed a bigger budget. We evaluate the movie for what it is, decide if it could have been improved with a budget, and if it will join our Keep Making Movies official recommend list. I'm your host, KJ, and with me is...
Tom.
And Kevin.
Today we are discussing Bradley King's Time Lapse. This is Bradley King's first feature-length film after directing a few shorts. In Time Lapse, we follow three friends that all seem to live together in an apartment and are something of property managers for the apartment complex. They find a camera that is aimed at their apartment in one of their dead neighbor's apartment, and they realize the camera takes a photo every day at 8 p.m. of tomorrow. They start to use this to gain money by betting on horses and feel compelled to recreate the photos exactly because they don't want to end up dead like Mr. B. The rest of the movie goes through some dangers of time travel. Jasper is killed. Finn is killed by Callie, who thinks she can change things by passing information to herself from the time machine. So Bradley King made this movie, and I really enjoyed it, guys. What do we think Bradley King's goals were when making this movie? When he was writing it, when he was discussing it with others, thinking about it, what were his goals with Time Lapse?
I suppose to make a... to finally explore these ideas of time travel that seem to be present in his short films. He has a Drive Time is the film he made before this about a time traveling car. I don't know very much else about it, but I imagine he's interested in these ideas and these paradoxes, and he wanted to make a film in which he could explore those basically in one room. The movie almost entirely takes place in one room, and I think his goal was, how can I explore these paradoxes if I cannot leave this room or can't leave this room for a very long period? So I think that was his goal.
So there's a woman at the end of the movie, or towards the end of the movie, called Dr. Heidegger. I thought this was a rather thinly veiled reference to the philosopher Heidegger, who I, you know, remembered was a philosopher, but wasn't really up on my Heidegger. So I took the liberty of looking into it, and sort of one of his central things was that there can be no difference between the subject and object of an observation. And I thought... that was kind of I suspect the writer slash director may have read a bit of Heidegger and thought this could be a movie.
Yeah, sure, right? Because the characters first seem like they're finding the time machine, but then get involved. And then I guess even Mr. B, the original creator of the camera, also got too involved with his observations and it got him. Or is that what we mean by observer and...
Yeah, observer and or object and subject.
Object,
I guess,
and subject,
right?
Yep.
Yeah, so I think that's... I mean, I haven't thought about it a great deal since I finished watching the movie, you know, merely minutes before we started recording. But I think that the point is that there's really no difference between someone who is acting and someone who is observing. And those things are fundamentally intertwined in ways that, you know, if you try to mess with it, you're going to end up, you know, confused and not understanding things and probably in a bad way.
I'm glad you picked up on the Heidegger reference. It went, I missed it entirely. I don't think I remembered her name, but from what I remember of Heidegger, it's like the observer looks out on something and therefore kind of brings it into his or her orbit, kind of actualizes it, right? There's this sort of that's that kind of tie there between observer and observed. And that seems to be what's going on in this movie, as you're pointing out, Kevin, like the camera is just looking on something, but by looking on it, it's making the thing happen. The silhouettes in the room, or the silhouettes,
right,
the photographs are being made because something is looking at you.
Yeah, I think it's a spin, or maybe an evolution of Kant, right? And Kant's big thing is, you know, there is there, or maybe there it's not that there is not a world outside of the observer. It's that the observer has no ability to access the world but through his perspective, right? And I think Heidegger's take on that is, well, if that's true, then the observer must be interacting with the subject, right? And I think it also goes hand in hand with some of the quantum mechanics stuff that was going on in the science world at the time that Heidegger was around as well.
Yeah, and I mean, they're literally observing photos of themselves and then making sure they recreate that. They're literally observing and then 24 hours later becoming that exact subject of the observer. Yeah, that's what the movie is.
Where it kind of breaks down for me, though, is where are these sort of machinations of the camera coming from? Like, it seems like there's things that they must do that come out of thin air. And why, right? Like, why do these things happen? And then the next day they must. So for me, maybe it would have been, you know, certainly a more complicated plot, but if there were some motivation for them to do these things separate from the camera told me to.
That was the movie that I wanted to see, was that there's this kind of, like what you're saying, Kevin, is that these poses are coming out of nowhere. And there's this kind of like, Beckettian, like the Samuel Beckett version of this movie, where instead of there being like an exciting, quote unquote, exciting episode with a gambler or a bookie or what have you, and there's action and death and murder and blah, 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 that instead it's just a bunch of kind of static nonsense. Like, it's just what the camera ends up doing is keeps you trapped doing nonsense all the time. And yes, you can make money, but you're just doing not, you know, like that ends up being the kind of joke. It ends up being a kind of, you know, Samuel Beckett or like Camus type of thing, where you have to keep doing this one thing over and over again, and it will never make any sense.
Right, right. Well, are you thinking like almost like a Shaggy Dog theory, or you often bring up
like waiting for
Godot? Yeah, would it?
Yeah, Beckett wrote that. That's
be in that vein.
Yeah. Samuel Beckett wrote that. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's the Beckett reference. Yeah,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Still haven't seen it.
Yeah, it's sort of a what are we even doing here kind of vibe, right? Like, mm-hmm. Oh, the camera told us to kiss. I guess we better kiss. Like, where did that come from? I mean, I guess later you might say it came from maybe the camera knows something and is, you know, trying to hint at something, but I don't think this movie intended for the camera to be sentient. I think it intended the exact opposite. Mm-hmm. So I think that begs the question, where are these sort of camera prompts coming from?
Yeah, and then even more than that, towards the end of the movie, characters seem to do things because the writer needed them to do things. Right, I forget exactly, but Callie is—it's like the final act. Jasper might already be dead. Finn is trying to figure things out, and she's like, "Well, why don't you lay down for a minute?" Because they needed him out of the living room for her to do, I guess, hold the note up or whatever. And it just—he wouldn't lay down there. He just went through this traumatic thing. There was not only was the camera kind of forcing them to do things; it felt like the script started forcing them to do things as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, do we think a budget would have helped if they had more money? Do you think it would have improved things? We would have gotten out of the apartment. Would that have helped?
I think maybe if they had the budget to take a rewrite or two of the script, that would have helped. I think, you know, this seemed to be like, a guy wrote this and maybe, you know, asked for some editing and then tried to film it. And I think if he had thought about the script a little bit more and maybe had the comfort that a larger budget comes with that script, maybe he would have come up with some better motivations and better dialogue to support those motivations. But I thought that the use of the money that they had was pretty good. I think they had some really decent cinematography. I thought some of the shots were very I guess artfully done is the right way to do it. I think some of them were creative and some of them were interesting.
Yeah, there was two shots specifically I want to talk about, and they kind of do the same thing. So early on in the movie, she's knocking on the door to Mr. B's apartment, and the shot is a profile of her knocking on the door. Audience, you can't see this, but I'm turning to my side and knocking. The camera pans left as if it's going to look through the window or you know, see her in the apartment through the window, but instead it sees her face on from the kitchen as she's opening the door. So the camera just pans, but the perspective turns 90 degrees without the camera turning. And then he does a similar thing with Jasper. I think he goes up or down, but the same idea. It's the profile and then the portrait. And I'd never seen that in the movie. It worked really well. I thought it was pretty cool.
I think also more money, we might have gotten somewhat more polished performances. And that this goes hand in hand with the script. These characters aren't really developed in any way. These actors aren't also bringing that much to it. I think the actor who played Jasper is maybe a little more. George Finn was probably the best of the lot, or the most animated of the lot. And so I think money would have helped with that as well. But again, I think they're handicapped somewhat by the script, which is not interested in them as characters, but as kind of chess pieces in this game he's trying to play, or trying to stage, rather.
I thought the sets were pretty good. Like, the apartment complex felt, I don't know, big enough, lived in enough. The actual apartment felt a little strange because it was mostly just that front room. But the apartment complex felt big enough with the security guard, and there was enough right around the edges that I thought that was well put together.
Yeah, I guess I was wondering where the neighbors were throughout some of it.
It's a little quiet.
Yeah, so like I thought maybe this would have done better in like a suburban or maybe even a rural setting with you know, somebody has a zoom lens or something like that, and they're, you know, taking photos from across the way in some fashion. I thought, you know, making it an apartment complex and making them somehow involved in the maintenance of the apartment complex, you know, it seemed like seemed a little forced.
How about that party? They had a DJ. That place was rocking. Again, the neighbors didn't complain about, like, that was...
Yeah, it was somebody's engagement party, too, right? It was like...
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right.
It was... They're like, oh, we can't cancel it because these people just got engaged and we have to celebrate them.
Yeah, that felt a little out of place.
By throwing basically a, you know, drug and alcohol fueled rager.
It's a little apartment.
Yeah, that's the way I'd like to celebrate my love too. You know?
Yeah. And do we ever meet those characters who get engaged?
I don't think so.
I don't think so.
Yeah, it doesn't matter, right? They're not interested in that.
How about the paintings? Did you like the paintings as a... I don't know if it was just lost on me because I'm not a painter, or...
I mean...
You know, it's a narrative device, the paintings, right? It was...
It is, but not... I know you have to see the paintings in the picture because that's the plot, but, oh, God, it would have been so much better if... The less of the paintings you could see, probably the better, because... And then you as an audience audience member can put the skilled art on the canvas and not expect this low budget movie to do it, which it really doesn't have the ability to. So they end up writing themselves into a corner with that.
It's just seemed like a device to paint Finn's character as, you know, this deep thinker type, you know, to contrast with Jasper's id, I guess. I'm not sure how I would describe Jasper, but I think he is intended to be the antithesis of the artistic thinker type.
And it also makes Finn selfish. It gives him a reason to go along with this destructive behavior as long as he does. He wants, and it also gives him an excuse not to propose to Callie earlier on. It's a dumb reason. I mean, she's like, what, you can't paint anymore? Because, you know, and granted, yes, he's also nervous about proposing or whatnot, but it makes him culpable in the sins that the trio commit. He's doing it to make paintings.
I think the writer/director sees the most of himself in that character. Mm. Right. And I wonder how much that influences, like, oh, like he's sort mostly the protagonist, and he's also the most likable, and he's, you know, the most creative and the most deep thinker of the bunch. I don't know. It seems a little bit self-congratulatory, I guess.
John Rhys-Meers is in it. He's the guy. He's the doctor who gets killed or who falls over and dies.
Who'd you say, Tom?
Oh God, what's his,
John Rhys-Davies?
John Rhys-Davies. Sorry, I said Mears. It's a different guy. John Rhys-Davies, Gimli and Indiana Jones.
Sala, yeah, even in the
Who is apparently he had scenes that were cut, but we see a photograph of him at one point.
Oh, I missed the photograph. I did hear about the scenes that were cut, and I don't think he had anything to do with the corpse that we see. You're right. Like that's not.
One would hope that they didn't use this man's time in that way. But he's in a photograph of him holding a sign.
Oh, okay.
I vaguely remember the photograph.
If you could see this sign, it's tomorrow.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
I didn't realize it was him because we're not on the photograph long enough to identify this famous character actor. But I guess I don't know how they got him to do this. I feel like that story is probably more interesting than the film. But
so what do you guys think? Does it make the list? Does it make the keep making movie list? Are we recommending this to future audience members? Is this joining the elite list of keep making movie lists?
So I'm going to say yes. I think it's worth a watch. You know, I think, you know, maybe, you know, don't expect to be blown away, but I think expect to think a little bit, especially if you catch the Heidegger reference and think about how that fits in to the plot of the movie.
All right. One yes from Kevin. Tom?
I'm going to say no, but thank you. I suppose it would be my thing. So maybe he'll make another movie or what have you. I'm going to go with a solid no on this one.
I'm the opposite, Tom. I'm a solid yes. I enjoy this movie a lot, especially after the camera is there. I think the wall of pictures is cool. It got me just thinking about things. I think when the bookie shows up, it starts to fall apart. And then the third act, it's got the fun twist at the end that Kylie kind of knew before everybody. But even the third act, the violence that the second act kind of prepares you for didn't quite do it for me. But audience, if you haven't seen it, I would go out and watch it. And guys, I'm super excited to try to get my hands on Bradley King's shorts. I did not have time before this episode, but if I can find him out there, I would love to see more by him, even what he's already done, especially if it's more time travel thoughts. So it's a yes from me. So Tom, that's a 2-1. So I'm thinking it's on the list.
It's on the list. Yeah,
it is on the list.
I don't get the end. Does she actually change the past?
Ah, so we have a few more minutes, audience. So we're going to jump into this, but it's going to be a mess. I truly believe this movie did not break the ink is dry rule. I think every step of the way, they did not change the past. She thought she could change the past. Absolutely. But I don't think the movie ever gave us evidence that the present or future was changed because of the time machine.
Yeah, I think the end is designed to provoke that thought and that discussion about, oh, did she actually change the past? And I think I agree with KJ. The answer is no. I think she thought she did, and she thought that she could fix things that have already happened. But I agree. I don't think she can. I think that's the fundamental hubris at the end of the movie, is she kind of gives up on the present, thinking that she can fix things in the past. And I don't think she can. And I think the director would agree she cannot.
You got to clean the blood off the window before you use the tape, or get really good tape. That's the only way to change the present.
Yeah. It was a very like Inception kind of ending of like, oh yeah. Can she change things? Mm-hmm. But I think the answer, or I hope the answer is clear here.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Tom?
I don't know what they were going for. I don't think so. I guess they were going for that Inception thing where did she or didn't she, that kind of conflict. I wasn't even sure if they were, though. I thought I was supposed to think she actually had altered the past, but I don't know how she would have, what that would have looked like, or what, I was completely baffled by the end of it. So clearly, though, she's not going to change the past after getting arrested. That we know, because the picture or the sign has fallen. True. So I think was a little bit of maybe a problem with the filmmaking, is that it's not clear what we're supposed to get from that ending.
No, but if she can change the past, doesn't she have another chance to? Right, like doesn't she have another chance to do this again? Or I don't know, maybe she doesn't. Maybe I'm.
Yeah,
But she can't in the last one. Regardless, she can't, right? Because the sign is fallen.
Well, what was her name? Heidegger. She also suggested the camera could be tinkered with, so you might be able to play games and get a photo to come from further in the past, or you might be able to play games there. If you can change the present, you might be able to play games with the camera and send a photo further back.
Yeah, but I think fundamentally, the information only goes one way, right? You can send information, or you can use information in the present that you get about the future. But I don't think, I mean, I certainly think you can't get information back to, or you can't use information from. Gosh, I'm talking in circles.
It would be kind of a bad.
I don't think that
situation.
You can change the past, right?
Yeah, the movie didn't present that you could change the past, but if you could, I think the way it would work. I don't know why, but the way it would work is she'd write another sign after she got out of jail, tinker with the camera to send it to the day she found the camera, and then old her would change things, so she'd never go to jail. She'd never have had to make out with Jasper. Maybe, I don't know.
She'd commit a double murder, and then when she gets out of jail in 75 years or whatever, she would have direct access to the machine again.
Well, if we're making a sequel to Time Lapse, she would probably from jail have somebody else do all this, because then it would be like Butterfly Effect. She wouldn't be in jail anymore, right? She would, who knows, but
yeah, I mean, it
Time Lapse today.
But she's changing. If she thinks she can change the past, then she must have experienced a different present.
Not necessarily. Right? You might just think you can change the past, even if Harry Potter, they think they can change the past.
Well, she thinks that she can experience the same present twice in different ways.
Okay.
Right? That's the fundamental thing that I think that the movie makers agree that that is a flawed piece of logic.
I agree.
Right. Mm-hmm. I think towards the end, you know, throughout the entire movie, I thought from Callie's perspective, this movie makes no sense. Right. And then at the end, they try to, I don't know. It seems like a shoehorn that they try to say, this movie actually only makes sense from Callie's perspective.
Right. That's the big twist. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then if you sort of adopt her headcanon about what's going on, I think, you know, you're supposed to sort of say, okay, this girl is nuts and she doesn't get it. That's not the way any of this works.
Well, it's official. Time Lapse has made the list. So please, Bradley King, keep making movies.
You can rate and review this show anywhere fine podcasts are available. For those viewing in YouTube land, if you haven't already, please like this video, subscribe to the Talking Studios channel for all our exciting content, and follow us on social media at Talking Studios. Check out other shows by Talking Studios, including Talking Pictures Trivia, where we explore movies through trivia, Limited Lexicon, where we play through text-based adventure games, Get the Point, where we slowly reveal a movie poster and try to guess which movie poster it is. And Adapt It, where we explore adaptations in various forms. Got a question for us? Call the Talking Studios hotline at 201-467-8679 and leave a message. It may be featured on a future episode. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to Keep Making Movies, wherever fine podcasts are found.
Audience, if you've seen any of Bradley King's shorts, please recommend them to us on Twitter at Talking Studios. And join us next time when we discuss another take on time travel, Beyond the Infinite 2 Minutes from 2020. Stay tuned for our first impressions of Beyond the Infinite 2 Minutes. See you next week. Next week, we'll be discussing Beyond the Infinite 2 Minutes. Tom, how was your watch?
I watched this a few hours ago. I had seen previews for it. I think I told you about it initially.
Yeah. This was definitely a Tom recommend here. Mm-hmm.
This is, yeah, I recommended this. I had seen pieces of it or trailers for it, but I had not seen the whole thing. And it just seemed to fit our model so well. It had time travel. It was low budget. You know, it seemed like something you would like. And fortunately, I also really liked it. I think that it was a lovely bit of choreography while being very, very gentle in its spirit. It has a lot of fun spirit. It's very spirited. It's very fun. It's very light. I'm impressed, and I think most people are impressed when watching it, or probably would be impressed when watching it, by how well everything is choreographed. It reminds me back in when Children of Men came out, how impressed everybody was with the single shot thing, which has since kind of stopped being impressive because the technology is as such that it's kind of like, if you saw Birdman, I don't find that single shot impressive at all. It's just cut together. You know, it's not real. But with this, there is an added element of time where certain things have to happen within a time. So because of that added complication that the director imposes on it, it actually makes that kind of choreography really fun again. It reminds me of when I saw Children of Men and saw those cool scenes. And the actors are a lot of fun. They're so kind of hopeful and buoyant and joyous in everything they do that it makes the movie seem light and easy. And compared to a lot of these low budget science fiction time travel movies we've seen, which always have this kind of dour note of, you know, if you mess with time, bad things will happen. This is a serious thing we need to think about, that type of thing. This movie has the same suspicions without any of the pretense. It's a lovely little 65 minutes, something like that. 65 minute watch.
Yeah, it's pretty short.
It's pretty short. Yeah. Yeah. KJ, how about you? How was your first watch?
Well, like you said, Tom, so you had brought this. This is actually, audience, some inside baseball here. This is the first movie Tom has brought to Keep Making Movies. And Tom, you were spot on. It was a lovely little movie. I enjoyed every minute of it. It was perfectly low budget. So I had watched it actually when you had recommended it a while back. More inside baseball, audience. We've been recording these kind of sporadically when we can. So it was a while back when this movie was kind of introduced. And the first time I watched it, I really enjoyed it, but I felt like either the actors were trying too hard or there was, I think I expected more of the film. But on my second watch, I realized, no, the actors were just being directed incredibly well. The silliness was fantastic. It was borderline Monty Python, very much so Tom Popo. Like, it was just a lovely, lovely comedy. And I enjoyed every minute of it. Or every 2 minutes of it, really. Beyond the Infinite 2 Minutes is available on Amazon Prime at the time of this recording.
Wow, Talking Studios,